where the two planes hit the towers and brought them down. It's a waste of time. Now, I don't agree with that latter one. I met some friends of Charles who we stipulated a debate about belief, and I contacted Charles, and so I want to investigate Charles thinks that the NIST, the official explanation of 9/11, requires reopening because it doesn't adhere to the facts. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that basically the case?
Because there are significant omissions and distortions.
Okay.
So are you on the email list? Yeah.
Okay. So, and I am relatively comfortable with that. We're both apparently rational people. The evidence really, I mean, it happened in one of the most populous cities on the planet during a weekday, 8 a.m, in full daylight, with cameras whizzing. Much more evidence could you have collected anywhere else in the world? And yet we've come up with different conclusions. And we both believe we've come to those conclusions rationally. Something must have gone wrong somewhere, and that's why I want to investigate. Where did we deviate? Now, I did send Charles a list, and I said, okay, where in the narrative do we deviate? And Charles said all of it. So from the hijackers to the planes hitting, or was it controlled demolition, or was it, you know, World Trade Center 7? You know, where do we deviate? He said, well, right at the beginning. So we'll be looking at the beginning later on and see what. See where we started to deviate. And we are, you know, I hope we also look at ourselves and say, well, you know, have we made assumptions that we shouldn't have? Are we aware of our own fallacies of thinking, our own biases? For example, let me give you a 9/11 example. What did the hijackers use? Sorry, I've got to use hijacker here, okay? But what did the hijackers use as weapons to take over the cockpit? Everybody says box cutters.
Right. Yeah. Box cutters.
Yeah. That it? Box cutters. Yeah. Most people believe, yeah, they went on board their box cutters. Now, someone did a study, and they went through everything. And this is from the official commission. And they found out that we don't really know what happened on the plane. The cockpit voice recorder didn't survive either the New York crash and was damaged beyond salvage in the Pentagon crash. The Flight 93 voice recorder doesn't start until several minutes after the hijackers took the plane. What little we know about tactics and weapons come from phone calls made by passengers and flight attendants. No one on Flight 175, which crashed into the World Trade Center, reported anything about weapons or tactics. One flight attendant on American Flight 11, which also crashed into the World Trade Center, said she was disabled by a chemical spray, while another flight attendant said a passenger was stabbed or shot. On the Pentagon plane, American Flight 77, Barbara Olson, I presume was a stewardess, reported hijackers carrying knives and box cutters. That's the only reference to box cutters in the entire NIS thing. But did not describe how they took the cockpit. And on Flight 93, passengers reported knives, but also a hijacker threatened to explode a bomb. The box cutter knife story isn't demonstrably false, but it served to divert attention from other weapons and mask the fact that we really don't have any idea how the hijackings happened on the plane. But if you ask anyone, box cutters. If someone had asked me prior to reading that, I would have said, box cutters. It's now entered the narrative, the official narrative or the unofficial narrative. And if someone was to ask me now, I would say, uh-oh. Okay. if someone asked me now, I would change my answer because I have more information. And I'm hoping. Well, I know that Charles, you know, we could debate with Charles all day, and it. Is anyone on the fence about how 9/11 happened?
Yes.
Okay, good. We've got one. Anyone else?
Sure.
Does it Yeah, okay, two.
Yeah, sure.
Three? Well, you may have some recruits here today. while we don't know everything, we're gonna have two versions. I am more or less comfortable with the official version, but I've got to admit that I was, you know, I can be challenged too. I'm not convinced by the evidence that I've seen from the other side, but why is that? Why am I not convinced? Because I have my own biases. I have my own fallacies in thinking, which I choose to ignore. I choose to accept. I mean, it's very hard to hold a feeling of being incorrect, of believing something you're not sure is the truth, or not sure is the truth, you don't believe is the truth. And yet we know everyone else has a different opinion. So why was I chosen to be the only one that holds the truth, and all you lot? You know, there's something wrong somewhere. We all have different, you know, opinions. And when does opinion, what's the line between opinion and fact? Is it a fact that the planes hit the World Trade Center, or is it my opinion? And what do I base that on? And I just want to run through a few. I mean, we all know our thinking is... I'd just like to say, before I start that, that when I did invite, when I got in touch with Charles, I find Charles extremely charming. And as far as I can tell, up to now, rational person. And I did promise him... Like, oh, yeah.
Can I say something about this? So the question is, if you don't believe the official version, why?
Well, we're going to explore. Yeah, that is exactly what we're going
to
explore.
And I plan to demonstrate to you why I don't. No, I don't believe the official version. I believe personally that this was a false flag event in which our government was complicit, either partially or fully, for the purpose of swaying public opinion to allow military incursion into the Middle East, consistent with the objectives of a particular political group that had a good deal of influence during that period of time, namely Project for a New American Century. And I'll go briefly through the white paper that they presented.
We'll go on to that.
Yeah.
Because you've made various claims in that statement, right? And there may be claims that people agree with, there may be claims that you disagree with, but there should be a reason, right?
Definitely.
But we also should examine why we make that decision. Lily.
Well, can I?
Yeah. You know, we should be aware. I mean, we've seen optical illusions, right? And we've seen how we can be fooled. Our eyes can be fooled. Oh, beautiful. So, you know, we know that we can be fooled, we can be manipulated. We both can. And the surety that I'm correct and he's wrong, I it's not 100% there. I believe my version, which coincides more or less with the official version, is more plausible with Charles. Charles is going to disagree with me, and we're going to examine where did we go wrong. If he's claiming that you know, we both adhere to the same rational scientific method, where did we go wrong? Sorry, Fred, you had a...
Yeah, I don't want to get off too much in a red herring, but just a tiny bit. I think we're all evolved creatures. And there's an awful lot of evidence that evolutionary psychologists are bringing up that the human brain was never intended to be sorting out evidence. The human brain is essentially there, so the evolutionary psychologist would say, is there to rationalize what you already believe, is there as confirmation bias. And that what we always do, pre-thinkers and others, with, and it's very, very hard to do anything else, what we always do is use our superb intellect to rationalize what we already believe, rather than to examine the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it seems, when you're asking why does he believe things and why I believe things, the fact is that we're all doing the same thing.
Yes.
we're justifying what we already have, rather than really looking at new evidence.
And from evolutionary terms, we both possess the same flawed brain.
The open mind apparently is extremely hard to deliberate. It would be normal for people looking at something to have different conclusions just because we most of the time do not operate on that. And when we say we are, we're deluding ourselves.
And we also have a layer where we have language. You know, when we talk about truth, we all supposedly know what truth means, but there's various theories of truth. You know, there's the correspondence theory of truth. A pig is warm-blooded. You know, is that true? Yeah, well, something is true if it corresponds to reality. It's almost self-defying. There's the pragmatic theory, the coherence theory, relativism, that nothing is absolutely true. It's what's true for Charles may be true for him, what's true for me is true for him, but there's no absolute truth. I don't think this applies in this particular case, but in things that can't really be known, there is a relativistic argument. There's the constructivist theory, there's the consensus theory. You say, well, truth is not a popularity contest. Just because more people believe it, it's not true. But again, with the language, take Pluto. You know, a bunch of astronomers decided, oh no, it's not big enough to be a planet. Therefore, how many planets do we have in the solar system? It changed. You know, based on the consensus of a large group of scientists.
But you would agree the truth didn't change, just a nomenclature.
The truth didn't change.
No, but what you call it changed.
Which truth? Yeah, exactly. I mean,
it's
the language.
Still there. It never changed.
Yes, but the language said it's no longer a planet. So what is a true statement yesterday of how many planets changed because we decided to redefine Pluto?
The truth that changed is what we call a planet.
Yes. Yeah.
But nothing out in space changed.
But then, yes.
Semantics.
It's just the definition, that's all.
But that's the layer of language that we have to be very cautious of.
Of course.
When we look at any given argument.
But then under it all, Phil, is what somebody called, and I can't remember who it was, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, which is that wherever you look at, whatever junction you look in anything physical and measurable, there is, if not an exact answer, an approximation, and a reason to think that there's not much fuzzier. Not much fuzzy. What am I trying to say? Not much below that where you're going to find any consistency.
And, the absolute truth of mathematics, I don't think can be reproduced in reality, you know. Science is always an approximation, right?
Science,
you know, the scientific, you know, what is scientifically true.
It's always a consensus. You can't really prove anything. So it becomes a consensus among people.
And we can peel back the layers until we get to some axiom, but we're never going to.
Scientific truth is tentative and amenable to new evidence.
My favorite statement about truth is when someone criticizes you about something and they say, I'm just being truthful. Well, that's your truth.
You know the minute they say that, they're lying.
Yeah.
Are we mixing up facts and truth?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Trust me, I came here to learn today. Because I'm not an authority on truth, opinion, facts, fallacies, biases. And I, I'm hoping, that's why I sit next to Stephen. You know, I'm hoping that I can learn. I just know that we have them. You know, the language is laid on top and what we call them, and whether I confuse them or whether I'm spouting more confusion than I'm solving, it's all possible.
Well, I'm kind of thinking you can disagree on what is truth, but often there are facts that you should not disagree with. I mean, the planes did crash into the World Trade Centers.
Is that true?
Yes.
You will find people that say it isn't. Now, what do you say to those people?
You find a lot of crazy people.
but I mean, there's should visual, you discount them?
There's visual evidence.
Yes.
There's visual evidence in optical illusion.
There's flat earthers, too. You should discount them, too.
There's visual evidence that the World Trade Centers came down.
Yes.
What causes is what we're discussing. Yeah.
Mm. Well, there
maybe, maybe in some cases, yeah. In
there's
some cases, no.
There's evidence that planes hit the World Trade Center, whether that brought it down or not, may not be a fact, but there's visual evidence that the planes hit the center.
I saw it happen on live television. But that was television.
Yes, I mean, I'm not disputing that. I believe that.
But there's one building went down just by the wreck.
But there is, you know, what do you say about World Trade Center Building 7? You know, what caused that to come down? You know,
gravity.
there is dispute. There are some things that seem obvious. And there are some things that seem obvious to me, which I was surprised when Charles challenged them. So I can't assume that, because it's obvious, it's true.
Thank you.
Make sure that but I agree, that you've got to draw the line somewhere between accepting any position.
I'm not sure where that goes. Somebody looking for...
Wait.
You don't believe in truth. If you believe that he saw them come down, well, that's true.
Well, that's exactly what we're investigating. You know, what is?
Started out today. We're going to talk about our beliefs.
See, I'd say it's a fact that they came down. What brought them down may be something you can argue about.
I agree with you.
They went down.
I agree with you.
It's not. It's. And on a truth, sure. It's nothing. It's just simply a fact.
Yeah. There's another building came down and wasn't hit by an airplane.
Yeah, well, World Trade Center 7.
All I'm saying is
building 7.
I'm not saying an airplane caused them all to come down. Right. That's a fact.
Well, we're going to hear the various arguments. Yeah. I mean, I really wanted just to introduce the fact that we have biases. We have, you know, the fallacies in our thinking. I'm sure both Charles and I have been guilty of confirmation bias. I tend to go to the sites that agree with me. I'm sure Charles goes to sites that agree with him. You know, and our views are reinforced. That makes our truth more solid.
Of course, confirmation bias. So that's the whole definition of confirmation bias.
I think the problem in this case is the one-off event.
That's another issue.
And yes. When you have a one-off event, it can't be simulated. It's not like a laboratory happening. So you cannot try to reconstitute it. So all you do, you look at what's happened and you make your best possible guess for it. Yeah. And bearing in mind that evidence is controlled by a government's agency, and it's quite well known that government agencies have their own particular agenda.
Yeah.
So, taking all that into account, I think a rational person would say, something happened here, what it exactly was, I don't think we'll ever know.
Mm-hmm.
And you just make your best guess about how to continue from here.
Uh-huh.
And we cannot confirm it. You cannot go back in time and do it. So,
but you don't have to guess from the photographic evidence. That's perfectly sound, reliable evidence. Photographs from every conceivable angle. We don't have to guess about whether there was a...
But it is correct. It was an unprecedented event. And this makes it very difficult to say, well, you know, this happened because... You can't say because this usually happens. This always happens. It's the first time. So it does introduce another... It introduces another difficulty in trying to explain it, because what is your reasoning behind saying, well, this is what happens when, you know, when planes hit buildings? You know, none of us know. It was a one-off thing.
But the fact that the plane hit the building is a fact.
I think so. I think so.
Okay, now I don't think anyone can argue with that. No,
there are plenty that argue
with that. Can we vote on it? I saw
that part in real time. Sadly, there are people who argue that the earth isn't round.
The earth is flat.
Yeah, right.
What is something was it a commercial airliner? You saw something that you think was a plane, okay, but it's not really clear whether it was a plane or if anything hit the building or it was a hole. Well, I don't know.
Okay, from the very first picture of him,
the guy's in the street and he turns around and there's
I think that to most, it is sufficient. What we saw was sufficient.
Sufficient
to be able to make an argument that yes, that did happen, right? But there are and Charles, you would agree with me, right? There are some people that do not believe in the theory that planes hit the World Trade Center. I can show you the science if you want.
there are many,
yeah,
including myself.
Of the hologram, you don't believe the planes hit the World Trade Center?
I don't believe that. Commercial 1960s, 1970s hit the...
Oh, you do believe a plane hit the World Trade Center?
Depends on how you define plane. It's a cruise missile covered by a military-grade program. Right. Yes, it could have been a plane.
So something in flight hit the World Trade Center.
We skip that presentation. We believe so, but that is not a certain lightning.
So so there we have it.
So people at this end can't hear people unless we speak up a bit.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You
hear
all right. Okay. I always have a complaint about that. Okay. Well, part of how disarming it can be is his gentleness of voice. So beware.
If at any point anyone can't hear anything of that, please raise your hand and I'll speak.
Yeah. Don't be fooled by his calm demeanor. I tell the same people about a British accent, you know. Doesn't mean anything. So, I would like to start off with, because this is a part I think, well, I thought, and I'm not sure now, but where we deviated was the hijackers. Can we talk a little bit about the hijackers?
Well, if you don't mind, I would like to concentrate on 4 points of the 9/11 Commission report, which I believe are in error or distorted or significantly missing.
Okay, you grant me 1 point, I'll grant you 4.
Right.
Okay? Can I go first?
The first... yes, go ahead.
Okay, but I just wanted to, again... you know, Charles is going to be making a presentation. Would you prefer that we wait?
Yes.
To ask questions?
I would.
Can you do it point by point though, so we don't forget?
And unless there is something, yes. There will only be 4 significant points.
Okay.
Take notes. Ask questions later. Unless it's something that's
we don't understand.
Yes. If you don't understand it, then speak up, and I'll answer immediately.
Okay. But can we take them? 1 point, then ask questions, 2nd point. Plus, if we wait,
I would prefer to go through the entire...
Oh, we'll indulge you.
And, it will only take about 20 or 25 minutes.
Okay. I just want to bring up the hijackers first. I know you have a question with that, and that's fine.
I'm not going to
address the
hijackers, except in passing. And a passing comment is that Robert Mueller, who at the time was the director of the FBI... admitted publicly that there is no evidence that the hijackers ever boarded the airplanes. There have been documented interviews, even interviews with State Department officials at 2 embassies in the Middle East of these very same hijackers who have complained to U.S. officials or to magazines. That they are alive and well, that they were never part of this, and what is the meaning of the FBI's accusing them? So these are well-documented facts. There's no evidence
indicating that they ever actually boarded the airplanes. And in fact, there is evidence that seven of them are known to be alive today.
Interesting. They have on the, one of the first things I read about the hijackers is, yes, there was never any evidence. And this was based on the manifesto, on the flight manifesto, where their names are missing. I'm sorry. I'm using the English version. Excuse me. On the manifest, that where their names are missing. Now, apparently when they first put these manifests together, when they started compiling lists, they went to the next of kin, and they said, it's okay, we'll release the name. Now, all the hijackers apparently had given one another as their next of kin, which made it very difficult to contact anyone. But this was eventually, the first lists were the list of victims that they could find out from the manifest of, you know, from the manifest that you know, they were given permission to release. Not all the passengers were on those manifests. None of the hijackers were. Now, this was a red flag, not a false flag, but a red flag to say, well, there's something wrong here.
Yeah,
so they looked. So they looked further. They found the I don't remember Judy someone or other. The Boston Globe obtained the manifest on Friday 11, flight 175 within a few days of the attacks. Only one was published, but this did include the hijackers, so the other one wasn't published. Subsequently, passenger lists were passed to Terry McDermott. I don't know who he is, I didn't copy that out. These contained some anomalies, missing passengers on the UAL flights, but the hijackers once again appeared. The manifests were released public at the Masawi. These matched the previous copies and included the hijackers. The 2008 release of the 9/11 Commission records has produced their copies of two of the manifests, which again matched previous versions and had the hijackers present. We also have a record showing that United Airlines General Manager of Customer Service, Teresa Rizzuto, passed the Flight 93 boarding passes to the FBI. The list in the FBI report shows hijackers present, as do copies of the passes themselves. So in reality, there's not a single manifest that excludes the hijackers, not one. And we have real manifests and passenger lists from more than one source that do include the hijackers. And it could be argued that the manifests were hacked and the names on the list don't really prove that these people got on the plane. But the idea that the hijackers don't appear on the passenger manifest simply doesn't stand up to scrutiny. They do, and...
Then why would we have the director of the FBI apologize publicly and admit that there is no firm evidence that they ever were?
The only evidence I have for him saying that is your statement right now.
That was a public statement that he made.
If you can direct me to it.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the arguments we have, you know, the fallacy of, what is it, argument from authority, where, you know, Charles is an authority. Well, I'm not sure he's a neutral authority for a start. But, you know, should we accept anything just because they are an authority?
Why don't we listen to Charles first and then this...
Okay. All right. This wasn't going to be a presentation about Charles. It was going to be a presentation about beliefs. But anyway, Charles, by popular demand.
Thank you. First of all, the reason that I'm interested in this topic is that at the time of 2011, I was employed by American Airlines as a 767 captain. And in fact, I've operated... both the 767 and the 757, which was flight 77, allegedly going into the Pentagon on numerous occasions as captain, and the 767 that went into, supposedly, into building number one as flight 11. I've operated both as a flight officer and as a captain. So I'm very familiar with the aircraft types. I know their limitations. I know how we interface with air traffic control. I know our cabin and cockpit procedures. And just to quickly answer Philip's question earlier as to how the hijackers could have accessed the cockpit, at that time, all of our flight attendants had cockpit keys. They could allow themselves into the cockpit at any time. And if there were actually a hijacker on board, he could have easily forced entry that way. I'm also a registered civil engineer in the states of California and Washington. I started out professional life as a civil engineer doing steel design on the Alaska Pipeline Project, river crossings, small bridges, and even some structural analysis of the Yukon River Bridge, which is a significant structure. So I'm familiar with steel design, the limitations of steel buildings, and I'm very familiar with the aircraft that supposedly were used for this attack, hence my interest in the subject and my interest in presenting my findings to you.
Charles, how long will this, the 4 points take? I want to make sure we have time to...
About 25 minutes.
Okay, that's right.
First of all, before we get into the 4 points, two items. One, is everyone familiar with the origin of the expression false flag?
False what?
False flag.
The origin?
A false flag, relates to square rig sailing vessels during the Napoleonic Wars. It was an accepted ruse de guerre to sail up alongside an enemy vessel while flying the flag of the enemy vessel, and then broadside, haul that flag down, haul your flag up, and start blazing away at the enemy. That is a version of false flag. Another version is more evil in nature, and that is an effort by a government to sway public opinion by using a false flag. And specifically, during the Napoleonic Wars, for example, if England wanted to declare war against France, they might, but they don't have a good reason for doing so, and public opinion is pacifist at that point. They might have done something, and in fact, there are recorded events of this sort where they would require one of their commanders to sail offshore an English village, flying the French flag, and then start shelling the village, killing 30 or 40 people, and then sail away. The people on shore would report a French vessel having attacked, and the British government is then justified in declaring war. That is a more evil version of the false flag. Now, the second point before we get into the 4 points I'd like to discuss is a white paper made by the Project for a New American Century. It's a political action committee, actually a think tank made up of very conservative types in the late 1999, early 2000 era. Members included Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Armitage, Richard Clark, Paul Wolfowitz, guys who inevitably ended up in the Bush White House. The white paper title was Rebuilding America's Defenses, where they take the opinion that at this point, the United States is the only superpower remaining in the world. Therefore, the U.S. should take advantage of the situation and invade strategic parts of the world to control their energy supplies, specifically the Caspian Basin. the doctrine was known as full spectrum dominance. The white paper went on to say that because of the pacifistic views of most Americans, this would take quite a long time to evolve unless we have a catastrophic and catalyzing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor. This statement was, this was signed by the members of PNAC in the year 2000. And in September of 2001, in fact, we did have a new Pearl Harbor event in the form of 9/11. So the points specifically that I'd like to make as to why I believe the official narrative is implausible and that the 9/11 Commission report is incomplete and distorted are the following. The speeds reported for the four airplanes that supposedly went into buildings 1, 2, and the Pentagon, as well as United 93 that crashed supposedly in a field in Pennsylvania, are far in excess of what the 767 is capable of doing at sea level. We see speeds that are reported at around 500 to 550 miles per hour. And a 767 will go that fast at 35 or 40,000 feet, true airspeed. But it does not have enough power, it doesn't have the structural integrity to withstand a speed of that sort at sea level. And I'll show you a specific copy of a limitation chart that we had at American Airlines. Here are some slides of the specific airplanes. This is the airplane that was used as American Flight 11. The United used as Flight 175. The American 757, which supposedly went into the Pentagon as Flight 77. And the United Airlines 757, which supposedly crashed into Shanksville as United Flight 93. This is an example of a performance envelope. In this case, it's a fighter jet capable of doing Mach 1.6. On the right side, you have the maximum speed possible. On the upper part of the envelope, the maximum altitude, and on the left side, the stall speed. For a 767, it looks something like this. On the right side is the maximum operating speed, 360 knots. This is an indicated airspeed. On the upper angle portion is our maximum Mach speed. In the case of the 767, it's 0.86. For the 757, slightly slower in both respects, 350 knots indicated and Mach 0.85. Normally, a climb profile in an entire flight profile would look something like this. We would take off, accelerate 250 knots indicated below 10,000 feet. At 10,000 feet, we would accelerate to about 280 knots. And we would maintain 280 knots up to about 22 or 23,000 feet, at which point Mach speed starts to control. So this upper line is the max Mach, but if we were cruising at a slower Mach speed, then we would parallel that until we get to our cruise altitude. And let's say our cruise altitude is 40,000 feet at Mach 0.82, then if you go straight down to the x-axis, you can see the indicated airspeed that would be on the pilot's airspeed indicator, about 230 knots. The indicated airspeed indicates how much pressure is on the airframe, and it's also a reflection of how much power is required to force it through the air at that indicated airspeed. The power requirements for a 767, we have about 61,000 pounds of thrust for each engine. That could power it to about 340 knots at sea level, but no faster. You could go faster in a descent, of course. 360 knots is the maximum airspeed that the airframe is allowed to withstand. And when you get out to about 430 knots indicated airspeed, the airframe self-destructs as a result of aerodynamic flutter, resonance frequency, and so on. This is not published by Boeing, but it's been empirically established in two events, Lauda Air Flight 004 in 1991, and Egypt Air 990 later in the 1990s, both of which were over water and for different reasons ended up being inverted and going into a vertical dive. And as they went through about 425 knots indicated airspeed, according to the flight data recorder, the flight surfaces on the empennage separated from the airplane. The wings went into aerodynamic flutter and destructed and departed the airframe. The entire fuselage broke up shortly thereafter. That's the maximum speed of this airplane at sea level, indicated 430 knots will be destructive. 360 knots is the maximum acceptable airframe speed, and 340 knots would be about as fast as the engines could propel it.
How much is that in kilometers?
Multiply by 1.6 by 2.
Multiply by 1.15 to get miles per hour, and then multiply again by about 1.6 to get kilometers. So the speeds, our speeds that we use in the aviation world are in knots, so I'm sorry if you're not familiar with that.
Well, okay, I just want to clarify, you know, I remember flying, you know, to Amsterdam and over the North Sea.
Yes.
They had a tailwind, it was a 747, and the KLM,
right,
you know, shows how fast they were going, and I remember, because I thought it was kind of awesome, that it read 1,400 kilometers.
Okay. There are several airspeeds that pilots deal with. Indicated airspeed, calibrated airspeed adjusts for instrument error, true airspeed adjusts for density altitude, and ground speed is an adjustment of all of the above, plus it adds tailwind or subtracts headwind.
So that's what we're talking about when we look at the collision, right? Ground speed.
We're looking at ground speed, okay. Yes. Because these speeds were measured by ground-based radar, supposedly. However, on that day, you have very little difference between ground speed and true airspeed because the wind was only 7 knots that day. And you're at sea level, so you have zero density altitude correction for true airspeed. So the speed that we're looking at as a result of ground-based radar is effectively the indicated airspeed in knots that the pilot would see. And those speeds specifically are United 93, 504 knots. 75 knots beyond the airframe destruction speed. American Flight 77 going into the Pentagon, 480 knots. 50 knots easily beyond its destruction speed. United 175, if you can believe this, 510 knots. 85 knots faster than any 767 has ever survived. And American Flight 11, 430 knots, which is right on the verge of credibility. Yes?
Those two flights that you mentioned that self-destructed,
yes,
the Egyptian one and the other, why would they have been going that fast? I mean, in this case, we're talking about something else.
Right.
Normal.
Well, very briefly, in the case of Lauda Air, they had an uncommanded thrust reverser of the left engine. That resulted in reverse thrust on the left side and full thrust forward on the right side, resulting in a yaw, an inverted flight, and then a vertical dive.
So it was a problem with the...
It was a mechanical issue, yes. In the case of Egypt Air 990, it was a psychologically deranged pilot who was intent on committing suicide. He forced the control yoke forward. The other pilot on the right side recognized what was happening and pulled back to counter that. There is a torsion bar underneath the floor that has a torsion link that will separate at approximately 50 foot-pounds. That happened, and at that point, then each side controlled its own elevator. The left elevator was commanding a downward flight, the right elevator commanding an upward flight. The result was a roll, inverted, and then a vertical dive. So, but these are... You know, I'll be happy to discuss these with you later, but they're unrelated to the fact, to the point here, and that is speed.
May I just address that?
The 9/11.
That you can't possibly be the first person who saw the discrepancy here.
I'm not, and there are many websites that you can explore that will give you further information. The 9/11 Commission report does not discuss the airspeed limitations of the 767 versus what the FAA and military radar reported. Second point is the I refer to this as non-Newtonian reactions between the supposed airplane impacts and the buildings. And let me just show you a couple of examples. This is supposedly a result of American Flight 11 going into the North Tower. You can see where my cursor is, all the way out to the tip of the right wing. It penetrated steel 14-inch by 14-inch columns. This is a light aluminum structure. People don't like me to say this, but airplanes are made of plastic and aluminum foil. That's about the extent of their structural integrity. They have to be in order to be light enough to fly. And there is simply no way that a light aluminum structure can penetrate a heavy steel structural beam of A36 steel.
That's just going fast.
Unless it's going for 30 knots.
Yeah, well, it's going fast.
Okay, in the case of American 11, yes, 430 knots was the reported airspeed. But I'd like to point out the fact that at the tip of the wing of any airplane, but especially the 767, that's only an aerodynamic shape out there. It's not supporting any weight. There's no moment. All of the moment is supported by the inner portions of the wing. The wing tip itself doesn't have any load, doesn't have any weight that it needs to support, except navigation lights out there at the very tip of the wing. And for that to penetrate a 14-inch by 14-inch steel beam is simply unreasonable.
It's saying all these are 14 by 14 steel beams.
Yes,
all
exactly.
Solid.
Exactly.
Solid beams, 14
solid
by 14.
Solid steel.
Well, is that silhouette the exact wingspan
yes,
of that plane.
Yes, it is, exactly. But my contention is, it could, this hole could not have been created by a 767. Simply not enough kinetic energy in the airplane to shear this much steel. It is conceivable that a small amount of steel could be sheared by an aluminum structure moving fast. But for the wingtip to have done this is simply inconceivable. It's a very non-Newtonian.
How much does the light weigh on the end of the wing?
I'm sorry?
How much does the light fixture weigh on the wing?
I don't know the weight of that. There are actually two lights on the right. You have the same lighting as ships. On the port side, they're red. Right. On the starboard side, they're green. And you have a white light in the aft. And for redundancy's sake, all of the commercial airliners have two of each. So you have two lights, the support, the frame, and a plastic housing over the top of it. I would guess perhaps 5 pounds or so.
Two of them at 5 pounds?
Yeah.
Going 400 knots?
430 knots.
I think that would go through a...
All right, let's consider if you think that is a reasonable hole to be made by an aluminum structure, let's continue on. And let's look at some of the so-called photographs of United 175 going into building number two.
When you say so-called photographs, are they photographs that you...
I don't know if they are Photoshop photographs okay. or if they are real photos of a hologram. But it is not a real structure that went into the building. So let's take a look at this picture. I hope you can all see it from the back.
Yeah.
It shows part of the wing actually disappearing and the matrix of the building re-establishing itself after the wing is supposedly penetrated on the left side. Let's look at another example, and this is the most telling non-Newtonian evidence that I have been able to find. This is United Flight 175, supposedly going 510 knots at the point of impact. When does the tail of an airplane know that the front of the airplane has struck something? The answer is the speed of sound in aluminum, which happens to be about 18,000 feet per second. It would take about 0.02 of a second for a pressure wave to go from the nose of the airplane to the tail. It also, at that speed, takes about 0.02 of a second for the forward part of the fuselage to be even with the surface of the building. So, in other words, by the time we see what we're seeing here, the tail of the airplane would have recognized the impact. The pressure wave would have reached that far. And at that point, we should be seeing extreme deceleration of the remainder of the airplane, separation of the flight surfaces on the tail, buckling of the fuselage, the wing starting to separate from the fuselage and become more parallel with the building. We don't see any of those things. We don't see any deceleration at all if you look at these time-lapse photos.
This is the second building?
Yes. This is physically impossible. What we're seeing here is not real. If you consider
where did you get the picture? Where did you get the picture?
There are several pictures on the various 9/11 websites.
Do we know who took it?
We do, and I'll have that resource information for you in the form of the pages that are being handed around.
So apparently, an eyewitness photograph
we can't trust.
We can trust either we can trust it is a photograph of an unreal event, such as a military-grade hologram.
So you think these are all doctored up somehow?
Or it is a Photoshop photo. Yes, I don't know.
That's doctored up.
I don't know which.
Okay.
But whatever it is not real. And it is certainly not a commercial 767 impacting this steel building. Likewise, we have Pentagon impact issues. In order for the airplane to impact the way it was supposed to, the left engine would have gouged a significant part of the yard in front of the Pentagon. That never happened. We would have had significant damage outside of the circular hole that was in the Pentagon, and that was not the case. We have supposedly a light aluminum structure going through three rings of the Pentagon. Each ring has an inner and outer wall, 18 inches thick, reinforced concrete. On the interior of each ring are steel columns surrounded by concrete. And we are to believe by the official narrative that it penetrated all six walls, several of the columns, without doing damage to the columns, and finally came out here on the inner ring of the C ring. Yet there was no evidence of that airplane ever having been there. And the official explanation is that it vaporized, which would be a first. And incidentally, Flight 93, we're told the same thing, that the airplane essentially vaporized. There was nothing left of it except the hole in the ground. That would be a first. And we're given the same information largely about flights 11 and 175 that went into buildings 1 and 2. There are discrepancies with the flight path that I'm not going to get into right now. But here's an example of other major crashes around the world and the physical remnants of the airframe after the fact. In the upper left, upper right, and lower left are real world events. The lower right is United Flight 93 at Shanksville, a smoking crater with no aluminum at all. The coroner found no blood at all, and scientists at the site could find no jet fuel at all.
Okay. May I
exceed that by about 5 minutes, because I'd like to do the but I think I can stay within 10 minutes. Now I'd like to go into, from an engineer's perspective, I'm taking out my airline captain hat, and I'm now looking at the steel structures from an engineer's perspective. These are Newton's equations for his three laws of motion. I'm sure you're all familiar with those. But I'd like to spend a little bit of time on this diagram.
There will be a test later, by the way.
This is a diagram of a stress-strain diagram of steel, specifically low-carbon steel. The steel used in the World Trade Centers was A36 steel, meaning 36,000 pounds per square inch tensile strength capacity.
Charles, we're not really going to understand the physics behind this.
Yes, you will.
No, we're not.
Yes, you will. Okay, basically this diagram says if you apply force on the y-axis, you can expect distortion on the x-axis. in this section, it is linear and elastic. Imagine a spring. If you pull on the spring and release it, it's going to come back. That is representative of this part of the stress-strain diagram. If you pull on the spring a little too hard and you permanently deform it, you're now in the plastic portion of the stress-strain diagram. And as you continue to distort it, you will actually increase strength of the steel. This is known as strain hardening. And you will finally have a failure at this point. So as engineers, we try to stay in this region from this point to about this point, giving ourselves a factor of safety of 4 or 5 when we're designing a steel structure. We want that structure to support 5 times the weight that we think it's ever going to be subjected to. All of the juxtapositioning of stresses, earthquakes, live loads, dead loads, wind venting moments, and so on. We want to stay in this region. For the World Trade Centers to collapse without significant distortion, that means that all of the support columns had to fail while still in the elastic range. We never saw any significant distortions of the building. We saw a sudden collapse of the upper 12 stories in the case of Building 2. And according to the National Institute of Science and Technology, it was the impact of the upper stories of the building on the lower stories that then caused progressive collapse. That's impossible. You would not have the simultaneous failure of 350 support columns while still in the elastic range. You would not have the upper stories impacting exactly on the corresponding portions of the columns a story below that. You would have a variety of distortions of beams, penetrations of flooring instead of impacting on its corresponding beam cross-section. Let's progress a little bit and look at the structure of the two towers.
Is this the final point? Because I want to give everyone an opportunity to ask questions. I've got plenty of questions, okay, I'm sure everyone else has.
There's one more point, which will be very short.
Okay.
But the point on structures is the acceleration of Building 7 and the number 1 and 2 towers was essentially gravitational freefall acceleration. Slightly slower for towers 1 and 2, but smooth, continuous acceleration. If there were to be progressive collapse, you would have to have impacts on each floor imparting force and causing failure at each level. That never happened. The acceleration was continuous, meaning that no force was ever exerted on the lower stories. And if no force was exerted, how did all of that material disappear? And my contention is controlled demolition is the only explanation. Now, let's go on to the last point. And by the way, none of these points so far are addressed in the 9/11 Commission report. The last point is the discovery and analysis of thermites in the dust of World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7.
Of what?
Thermite.
It's an explosive material. Water.
Explosion.
Thermite is an incendiary. It is not an explosive unless it is augmented with certain additives such as sulfur. But I've made some thermite, which I'm going to demonstrate right after our meeting here today.
And outside of the ground.
Outside of the
ground. We want to come back next month.
Yeah. But the points of the thermite being found are these. In the history of steel frame building construction, starting in 1880, there has never been a collapse of a steel frame building due to fire. Period. On 9/11, we had three buildings collapse, supposedly due to fire, all steel frame. I worked out the probability of that happening, and I came up with a number of 1 in 127 trillion. Hmm. I contacted the mathematics friend of mine, who's a pure and applied mathematician in Alaska, and asked him to confirm my number. And he reported back this morning, you're a bit conservative. His number is 1 in 47 quadrillion. So this is effectively indistinguishable from zero probability, or statistically impossible to have three steel frame buildings collapse due to fire in one day. It has never happened before. It has never happened since. But we had three buildings on that day. So how unlikely is this? Does anyone here know the melting temperature of steel?
About 1100 Celsius.
Celsius, right, about 2750 Fahrenheit. Jet fuel burns in open air between 600 and 750 degrees Fahrenheit. 2,000 degrees cooler than the melting temperature of steel. 1,000 degrees cooler than the temperature at which steel would significantly weaken.
What about the other flammables in the buildings?
That is paper and other carbon products, wood, office furniture and such, and that burns at an even lower temperature, 450 to 600 degrees Fahrenheit. So how do you get a maximum 800 degree Fahrenheit fire, and in fact cooler than that, because
can I ask you this? It obviously did come down, and there are explanations for this. Why don't you believe the alternative explanations, that the construction of the building was unusual? Normally they built skyscrapers with external frames, which they filled in the World Trade Center, they use spans. Is that correct?
Let me go over.
And that it's a question of, when you're looking at failure, and I think you pointed out before, it's an unprecedented event. They're not engineered to withstand this sort of event.
I beg your pardon.
Let Charles finish.
I beg your pardon.
I
beg your pardon, Philip. This building was designed for a rapid impact of a 707, which at the time of the design was the largest airplane that we have. Sure. Max takeoff weighed 330,000 pounds. The weight of the two 767s was less, because even though they are larger airplanes and they have a higher maximum gross takeoff weight, in the case of the 300 series 767, 410,000 pounds. These were 200 series, max gross takeoff weight about 370,000 pounds, but they were only fueled for a short transcontinental flight, 5.5 hours. So they only had 70,000 pounds of fuel, and they were lighter than a Boeing 707 fully loaded, which was the design impact.
But when you told us that the wings are nothing but plastic and aluminum, did you forget to mention that most of the fuel is in the wings, right? And that has weight, and they just take off. So they had more momentum than just plastic and aluminum.
Of course, there are three fuel tanks in the 767, a center fuel tank and two wing tanks. and the wing tanks are inboard. So yes, the fuel presents a significant mess, but let's look at imagine a dull pair of scissors trying to cut through steel, and then cutting through thin aluminum, and then cutting through fuel. I think you'll agree that the sheer resistance of the fuel is going to be significantly less than a steel 14 by 14 column. The probability of fuel flowing around a column is much higher than slicing it. That's a simple engineering perspective.
Can I start with the questions? Because I'm sure, do people have questions about...
I believe I've essentially covered everything, but I do want to...
I'm sure you could talk to us for hours, right?
Hours, literally. I do want to...
I'm sure I don't
want to make one addition to this last point on thermite being found in the dust. This was done by Professor Niels Haaretz of the University of Copenhagen and Dr. Stephen Jones of University of Utah. They found both reacted and unreacted thermite in the dust of buildings 1, 2, and 7, but they also found nanothermite, reacted and unreacted. Nanothermite is not something that you can, like I did, make in your kitchen. It's a military grade product, and in 2001 there were only three areas in the United States that I know of capable of producing nanothermite. Lawrence Livermore Laboratories in California, Los Alamos in New Mexico, and the Naval Research Lab in Virginia. So this operation, if nanothermite was found, has obvious ties to a military organization somewhere.
Do you have a complete narrative of 9/11? Or is it just the four points that have been explained?
These are the only points that I felt I would have time to discuss today.
But just in general, do you have, did the planes take off? If so, what happened to them? Rather than just say, well, the planes took off and it was a missile made to look like a plane that went into World Trade Center.
I have I have information and my own theories on that. I don't have time to discuss that today.
Charles, what is the flashpoint of a thermite?
The question is, what is the flashpoint of a thermite? Flame can be initiated in thermite at about 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. Very difficult to get it to burn. You can't use a match. Mm-hmm. I'm only able to do it with potassium permanganate and glycerin reaction to get a high enough temperature to get the thermite to ignite. Yes, sir.
Well, I use a form of thermite for doing welding copper wires to steel pipes.
Right.
And that reignited with a spark. Anyway, that's not the important question that I've got. My big concern, I've read all the material that you presented, seen numerous YouTubes and so on, and my big question mark is this, that there were planes that took off, there were passengers on that, those passengers never came back.
Correct.
So that implies, if your narrative is correct, that somebody deliberately destroyed those planes in some manner. And where they were destroyed, we don't know. Because they've disappeared, the passengers disappeared.
Yes, interesting side note on that point. The two American airplanes involved were immediately reported as being destroyed after 9/11. In the case of the two United airplanes, they remained on the FAA records as in service for a period of 4 years. I don't know the explanation for that, but I have spoken to some United Airlines stewardesses who have told me that they're sure that they have flown on one or both of those airplanes after 9/11.
What about the passengers?
Good question.
Because the passengers certainly didn't come back.
Not only the passengers, but 17 of my colleagues did not return.
I have a comment, and the reason I find this hard to believe is because it requires me to believe that there's people out that they are so competent to have hidden all of this conspiracy that was going on.
Right.
And I just don't think our government or any corporation or any set of people would have been able to hide successfully for this number of years all of the communication that would have had to have gone on behind the scenes to make this happen.
Good point, but it's just
not possible.
But when you say it's not possible, is that your opinion or is that a fact?
Well, given I used to work with government.
Yes.
Given my experience with government and at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, nobody could keep a secret like this. It's just not possible.
But this is your opinion.
This is my opinion, but I'll stand by it.
I would point out the Manhattan Project during World War II, where we developed an atom bomb. We had something like 30 or 40,000 people working on that.
And in one place.
In one, well, yeah, actually in a variety of places around the country.
And
the secret never got out.
It did. The Russians knew all about it.
Yeah, it did get out. It wasn't that secret.
Yes, sir.
I'm wondering, does the report say that, I'm only interested in the second building. The speed of the plane, are they estimating how fast the plane was going when it hit the building?
Yes, and this is based on supposedly on ground radar, either FAA or military radar.
Okay, and what's the stall speed of that plane?
Oh, well,
roughly.
Stall speed is a function of configuration and weight.
I understand what stall speed. What is it?
In that configuration, at that weight, with flaps up, slats up and gear up, the stall speed would have been somewhere between 185 and 190 knots.
Okay. I was watching television. I turned it on almost instantly, well, maybe about a minute after the first incident. And I was watching a reporter talking. When that second plane came bank to the left, coming in from the east, that looked to me like near stall speed. I mean, it was floating, and it was turning. It couldn't go fast to turn like that.
Well, remember, this is an airplane with a fuselage that's 200 feet long and a wingspan 165 feet. It's going to look like it's going much more slowly than it really is.
No, it was not going as fast as they're saying it was going.
Well, I don't disagree with you. But I don't have the answer. Lou Raskin was kind enough to forward to me the sea level performance characteristics of the Tomahawk cruise missile. And that will go about 500 and some odd knots at sea level. It's designed to do that. But a 767 will not.
No, I agree.
Yes.
Well, first of all, comment that this was all about beliefs that we all hold, and how we can listen to something like this and see our beliefs reacting around the table. And I think we're seeing that.
I hope your beliefs are going to be shattered.
My beliefs are what you're saying.
Yeah.
I already feel, I think just using your own brain and logic, what we were told is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And also, it's just like JFK.
Now, do we all believe, everybody here believes the narrative?
Right.
So,
you know, it's...
There's someone on the
Just a quick question. Comment. There was a United Airlines pilot, Philip Matthews, has written two books on this subject, the first of which is called The Big Bamboozle. And his point is, the longer an individual is bamboozled, the more likely he is to actually believe.
It applies to both of us, John.
I have a couple of questions, so
I'll come back to you.
Can we just rotate them and give it? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
The graph you showed about the strength of steel
right.
and the breaking point and the safe zone, the heat played no part in that graph.
Oh, yes. That definitely is subject to temperature. It's temperature specific.
I don't think I saw temperature on that chart.
No, you didn't. This would have been at standard temperature and pressure.
Well, my point being, there was an intense fire on that floor of all of that kerosene burning, and there was probably air flowing through there like crazy, too.
No.
So it's going...
Let me finish.
And so it took a while for that floor to collapse, and I don't know, was it 10, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, how long?
In the case of building number one, it was almost 2 hours. In the case of building number two, it was about 1 hour.
With that fire raging in there, that steel had to be weakened significantly.
No, that's not the case. You hear expressions from the news media such as, raging inferno. And it's very easy to repeat that, but we did not have a raging inferno. We had two or three levels of fire in each of the buildings. We had black smoke indicating an oxygen-starved fire, which is cooler than normal. We had jet fuel at best in open air burning at 800 degrees Fahrenheit, and steel melts at 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't even weaken until 1,800 degrees.
Isn't your point is that this chart was not really representative of what was the situation in the building at that time?
No, this graph that I showed you will be applicable up to in the vicinity of 1,500 or 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit, and we never reached those temperatures.
PBS did a program on this, what caused it to collapse. It wasn't the steel, it was the connectors that connected the floors to the steel.
They weakened.
And they weakened, and they weren't made out of steel. And they weakened at around that temperature and caused the floor to collapse from one. The steel was still standing. Yeah. It's the floors that came down.
I'm going to, I take issue with the PBS reports.
But you never mentioned that. You just focus on the steel.
Yes. PBS. Okay, there are a couple of problems with the PBS report. They claim that because of the weakened connections, there was a general pancaking effect of the floors down to the bottom. They do not say what happened to the central core of the building, which is an integral structure in and of itself and should have remained standing, but didn't. That's unexplainable. I'm going to bring your attention to this photograph of molten metal coming out of building number two. This is in spite of the fact that we see dark black smoke indicating a cool fire. So the maximum temperatures would have been easily under 800 degrees Fahrenheit, jet fuel burning in open air, oxygen starved. Yet we have molten iron.
And this is definitely molten iron.
Yes, definitely. And I'll
show you. The source of this photograph?
I'll show you another that will compare molten iron to molten aluminum.
Uh-huh.
And that is the next picture here.
So
there have been some theorists who contend that the molten metal coming out of the building was actually from the airframe of the 767. But this is what molten aluminum looks like. It's a silver blue color. And this is what molten iron. Iron is the primary constituent of steel. Steel is 98% iron, maybe 2% carbon, manganese, nickel, and a few other trace elements for various various characteristics.
It is silver blue under these conditions. And the thing that I always come back to is that it's such an unprecedented event that to be able to look at something and say, well, this is the way it behaves, therefore it can't be true, is problematic.
Well,
and it's not saying I know the truth, but
for a metaphysicist, perhaps
apples and oranges to
for
say
for a scientist who uses spectrographic analysis, no.
And that was done. Spectrographic analysis was done on
not to my knowledge, but the pure color, it. Looking at it is a version of spectrographic analysis.
I agree that if you melt aluminum, it's going to come out like that.
Yeah.
In the World Trade Center, I have no idea. To me, it's as much speculation that it's molten iron as it is anything else.
Well, I challenge you to show me any photograph of molten aluminum that looks...
To find another World Trade Center that I could...
Could be gasoline.
Yes, sir.
Yes, it could be anything.
Changing the subject here a little bit, the terrorists trained in Arizona, none of them, according to their instructors, had any interest in learning how to land the plane.
Right.
Can you address that?
Well, my view of everything involved in the aviation aspect of this story, from the hijackers to the airplanes involved, is that it was a false cover for the real cause of destruction, which is controlled demolition. On all three buildings, by the way, 1, 2, and 7 was never struck by an airplane. And are we all aware of the fact that building 7 came down later that day at 5:20 in the afternoon, after no airplane collision?
Well, there was damage to the building, though.
Very little. Two floors were on fire. And those fires were largely extinguished at the time of the collapse.
Well, what happened to the plane?
Mention the BBC
report.
There's
a question about...
Excuse me. Lou just brought up an excellent point, and that is something that I haven't brought up yet. That is prior knowledge of the event. And... Jane Standley, a BBC reporter, reported the collapse of Building 7 20 minutes before it actually happened. And as she was giving that report, you could clearly see Building 7 in the background. She was
over her left shoulder.
She was in an office building facing Building 7, which at that time was known as the Solomon Brothers building.
In this case, the fact that she could have been confused in a day that was just chaotic is less plausible than a theory of this.
She's
incredible.
Jane Standley specified the Solomon Brothers building has just collapsed 20 minutes before it collapsed.
I don't disagree with you.
What can possibly be ambiguous about it?
Because the information that was coming out of that...
She said there was reports
coming from everywhere.
They tried to cover it up in a very insufficient fashion.
It was an embargoed news report.
Again, back to the hijackers.
Who's they?
If they... The deep state, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the people who didn't leak for 10 years.
If the hijackers, if they didn't exist, but they actually exist in Saudi Arabia, why would they, you kill all these people, why wouldn't you eliminate the hijackers who are allowed to live and go around saying, well, I'm still alive? Which seems... And why would you pick Saudi Arabia if you want a war with Iraq? Why not make them Iraqis?
Are you proposing that the CIA should disappear them?
I am saying that if your motivation is to go war with Iraq, don't say that these mythical hijackers are from Saudi Arabia.
They're either competent or incompetent.
Again, I consider this irrelevant issue because the entire aviation aspect of this story was a cover-up. The FBI had, Robert Mueller had to defer reports coming into the field, from the field, regarding agents suspecting potential hijackers training in Arizona. He didn't want to hear about it. It was too early for him to hear about that, so he deferred the reports. Had he accepted the reports, he would have had to have acted on them. And had he acted upon them, the whole cover story would have disappeared. So it's really irrelevant whether...
So who created CIA or FBI?
CIA or FBI
was behind all of this?
I don't know the perpetrators, sir, but we know that funding has largely been done by Saudi Arabia. Saudi is an ally of the United States. We both have interest in getting rid of Iran, for example. And so there were shared political motivations between Saudi and the United States, whether it was FBI, CIA, the Tripartite Commission, I don't know.
What's going first? Fred? Okay, Fred?
I'm less interested now in particular things. Because Charles has given us stuff that I don't know an awful lot about, but raises serious questions, on the one hand. On the other hand, some people have said it just isn't plausible that this kind of secrecy is going to take place. And this is often the kind of situation we have in Bolivia. That people give something and I can't explain what they said, but somebody else says something, I can't explain how that could have been possible, and then what do we do then as people who are trying to make sense of it when we have this and this? I'm not going to spend the rest of my life trying to sort out whether it's
I have a solution to what you should do, Fred. I'm passing around a couple of brochures right now. These are from a group that I belong to called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We are about 3,000 registered architects and engineers who believe that the 9/11 Commission report is inadequate and that we need a new investigation done by an impartial third party. If you believe that there are enough irregularities, enough omissions and distortions in this report, then I encourage you and all of you to go to this website, look at the petitions. Lou Raskin and I have already signed the petitions, and consider signing the petition yourself, which is a request for Congress to initiate a new investigation, truly impartial.
I think Fred's point was, though, that he now has some information, right?
On both sides.
What do you do with it?
What do you do with it?
Because, unfortunately, and this is what I...
Necessarily getting into all the details on here. What do we do when faced with this?
Because
kind of
this was presented, this is one side, right? So hopefully we would have, some sort of rebuttal or some sort of alternative explanation. But in this case, we have only had one explanation of what's being said.
Well, I'm not giving you an explanation of controlled demolition. I'm giving you an explanation that the 9/11 Commission report is inadequate. Any rebuttal will have to take the position this report is 100% accurate.
But you casually mentioned that, this cruise missile can be covered in. There was this implication that there was other ways to explain what happened.
There are always
and this
things.
Proves,
I did not.
I know you didn't state it.
I did not prove or attempt to prove a position on, in fact, I believe I said outright, I don't know what struck the buildings. I don't know exactly the energy force required to take down World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7. But I do know that it took more energy than was available kinetically in the airplanes, potentially, and chemically in the form of the jet fuel.
Would they have known that before the event? The people designing this? Would they have known that before?
Of course, but they would depend upon a gullible public believing.
But they know they would have had eventually, you know, someone pointing out.
I think the
flaws in the official narrative.
I think the trade-off is, can we put this off long enough that it will go into the dustbin of history and no one will be concerned about it any longer?
I think it might be there already.
So I got the gentleman there with this. He's been trying to ask a question.
Quick related questions. I'm pretty familiar with most things about 9/11 and the truth movement, conspiracy, whatever you want to call it. But you mentioned something early on that caught my attention, and so I'm curious about two things. One, what is the alternative or your explanation for how the holes got into the building? That just happened to be plane shaped if it was not caused by a plane. And two, all of us who were watching the live broadcast and saw on all broadcast channels what appeared to be a jetliner crashing into the building, what were we seeing and how was that achieved at that scale?
Point number one, the exact shape of the hole could be done by shaped charges, pre-positioned. There were more than adequate opportunity to do this. For a year and a half prior to the event, there was a major elevator renovation going on in Towers 1 and 2. George Bush's younger brother, Marvin Bush, was the CEO of Securicom, the security company that oversaw security for both buildings. There were more than adequate opportunities to position a shaped charge that would cut that hole exactly.
At the same point
exactly.
That the plane went in.
Precisely. That it would be.
What are the chances of that?
Well,
quadrillion.
No, I would say 100%. Because obviously, if this was a hologram or even a cruise missile, or Photoshop pictures after a cruise missile impacted. The cruise missile is equipped with navigation capable of getting it to within 20 to 25 feet of its intended target. Now, your second point, what did we see? Well, either we never saw airplanes hitting, and what we're looking at are Photoshop pictures. And there is some evidence that that could be the case. But it's also possible that we could be looking at actual photographs of a military-grade hologram. And there are such things existent today. Let's not out of hand discount the possibility of technologically superior devices such as this.
What about the first? I saw the first plane fly around the first building and hit the second building.
Tens of thousands of people were on the ground.
Well, but tens of thousands of people did not see the impact. They heard the sound, and they looked up and they saw an explosion. Tens of the people who did see an airplane said it was perfectly quiet.
They saw the second one, though. Everybody was looking at it.
Yeah, they saw the second one. But there is some question as to whether or not we are looking at a Photoshop picture or are we looking at a real picture of an unreal event.
It was a live broadcast. Somebody plugged into a live broadcast.
Yes, I know.
And superimposed a flying airplane that we all saw.
And every major network in the world that was broadcasting live, you're saying that they inserted some sort of holographic image?
No. The holographic image would be a military-generated image. And if that's the case, then photographs of the hologram would be real photographs. And that hologram, yes, videos. And that hologram would be directed precisely to the hole that was cut by shape charges at 100% probability. So that is a possibility. I don't claim to know the answer as to what actually struck the building, how it is that we believe we saw commercial airplanes actually striking the building, but I do know that they behaved in a non-Newtonian fashion, that it's physically impossible for them to have reacted.
But you mean non-Newtonian from the explanation? Because obviously they did behave Newtonian. I mean, they didn't suspend Newtonian physics for the morning.
Well, let's look at Newton's second law, equal and opposite reactions. If an airplane is impacting the building, the forces on the airplane are equal.
But you're saying the explanations are non-Newtonian, not that it isn't.
Well, I'm saying the photograph is non-Newtonian.
The one thing you have proven is that one photograph where the tail didn't go in,
right.
That photograph is a fake. But all the rest of the photographs
It may not be a fake.
Photograph's a fake.
It could be a real photograph of the hologram.
No, that's way out there. Okay. I'd rather believe that photograph's
all right.
a fake.
Let's,
Farron's going to plan this. Farron's the thing. I want to get some sort of disaster, this false flag thing. All of a sudden, my intelligence said, look, these Arabs are planning this thing. I said, great. We'll monitor them, see exactly what they do, and we'll supply them with information. We'll sort of tell them, in fact, where they're going to fly into them. We get all of that done. So you get this, the genuine thing happening. These people are doing it exactly, but it was all known before. So that's the explanation for why a real plane came and smashed into the thing. Also, the people knowing, assuming that they knew all the things that you brought up, would know that they had to make it bigger, so they planted all these charges after the fact. But they knew it was a real plane going to do it, and they just allowed it to go ahead because it was all part of the plan. It all fitted in very nicely to what they wanted to achieve.
Well, that is a possible explanation as well. And this could have been under remote control to a very accurate impact point. A couple of points on technology, which may seem unrealistic to us here in the civilian world. The Tomahawk cruise missile has GPS navigation and a ground terrain recognition system to update the GPS. And the combination of these two is sufficient to allow it to get within 20 feet of its intended target, sometimes closer. During the Gulf War, some of my colleagues at American reported launching Tomahawk cruise missiles with multiple warheads, each GPS controlled and striking accurately their target. And at the end of the depletion of the multiple warheads, flew over the enemy runway, climbed, did a loop, and dove vertically into the runway to crater it. I mean, this is 20-year-old technology. Let me give you one other example of technology that may seem unreasonably advanced to us, but is every day for the military and even commercial aviation. The 767 that we saw photos of has a navigation system consisting of inertial reference devices, three inertial reference independent systems, each system containing three gyroscopes and three accelerometers, one for each axis. The gyroscopes are stuff of Einstein's relativity theory, they're laser gyros that emit laser light from a diode, from both ends of the diode simultaneously at the bottom of the gyro, reflect the light on prisms, and then focus the intersected light at the top of the gyroscope. You would suspect that a gyroscope rotating would have light coming out of one end of the diode traveling slightly faster than the other, but per Einstein's theories, we know that the speed of light is always constant in any reference frame. What does change is the wavelength. So as the gyro rotates, the laser wavelength decreases on the uphill side and decreases on the downhill side. It's focused on a device similar to a Michelson-Morley interferometer measuring phase shift, and that's applied to a very accurate time base to measure total time of rotation, and therefore the total displacement angularly. And that information is then sent to a signal generator where it goes to an LCD screen in front of the pilot and is translated as angle of bank or angle of pitch. Likewise, the accelerometers...
Why would we find that implausible?
Well, because of the fact that it is 37-year-old technology for the 767, uh-huh. And for the military, it existed 50 years ago. It was the same navigation system that is on the space shuttle.
I can't pretend to understand it, but I don't find so today, technology per se implausible.
For the average person, this may seem unbelievably advanced, but it is in fact 50-year-old technology as far as the military is concerned.
I have two questions.
Yes.
One focuses on the people and their disappearance and some sort of history of someone who checked these people in. It must be somebody who knows something about them boarding the flights and how they could just disappear unless it was a parallel flight that really was taken somewhere else. But number two, why haven't people done experiments to see if they can actually duplicate this concept, even miniaturization of smaller steel being impacted by aluminum? You would think that engineering schools or research organizations would conduct these experiments to see the plausibility of what we all believe or what we were all told versus what are the facts against them.
Do you know they haven't?
Sorry?
Do you know they haven't?
I'd be surprised if no one else knew that these experiments had taken place and were published.
Yeah, there have been a number of structural analyses. As with any analysis, structural aid involves some assumptions. We don't know the exact mass of all the furniture on every floor. We don't know if every single weld that was supposed to have been done was in fact done. We don't have all the quality control reports. But there have been studies, both pro and con, the progressive collapse theory. The one definitive study that I could refer you to is by Dr. Halsey, who is the professor emeritus of civil engineering at the University of Alaska. And they have, in conjunction with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, have done a comprehensive structural analysis of Building 7, which was not impacted by airplanes. And they have disproved the National Institute of Science and Technology hypothesis. Yes?
My mother and I were watching as this all took place, and both of us, she's gone now, but she's a few generations older than me, and what does that mean to me? Whatever it is. She, But both of us looked at it, and neither one of us are engineers. My dad is, but he wasn't there. But we both said, those are implosions.
Right.
We just from other, having seen other buildings come down, this was ridiculous that anybody would think, I felt that it was ridiculous to push off on the public that this, because this was a whole different thing that's supposed to be happening. How come they all came down like implosions?
Right, it's
that
complete.
That didn't make any sense.
Anyone with any scientific background at all would, by inspection, see that this is a hoax.
That's what we thought.
And I agree fully with that.
I wanted to ask one thing about the vaporization of those two planes. And you said that had never happened before.
Four airplanes.
Well, but you were talking about the two, the one that crashed in Philadelphia and the one at the Pentagon.
United Flight 93 and American 77, respectively, yes.
Yeah, and that they're saying, oh, they just vaporized. That's why there's no evidence. Why? How can they, whoever the officials are that are telling us that, expect for anybody that's going to look into this to believe it when it's never happened?
I agree, and especially with the inconsistency that the Armed Forces DNA laboratory was able to get DNA from 95% of the passengers on that flight, supposedly, in spite of the fact that the airplane had vaporized, all of the metal had vaporized. It's completely implausible. Yeah. Yes, sir.
The point about, we all saw it. I saw it on television. Well, I've also seen Star Wars, and I really believe some of that stuff that was happening. So the point of the technology, of cinematic technology,
right,
of being able to create a scenario that looks real and feathered into a real live thing is very possible, it would seem to me.
Right. We know that there was some collusion, at least with the BBC and the perpetrators of this event, because BBC had prior knowledge of Building 7 and reported it by mistake too early. Excuse me. It is possible that there could be a similar collusion with the media and the photographs that were being projected. But I think it equally likely that the photographs were real and they were of a military-grade hologram that was being accurately projected into the building. There are examples that you can find on the net of military-grade holograms being used to project the images of tanks on a battlefield to discourage an enemy force. So this technology does exist. Yes, sir.
You haven't mentioned, I've read some of, seen various YouTubes on it, and there was interesting narrative regarding the plane that supposedly hit the Pentagon about the flight path it took is virtually impossible for a novice pilot to achieve, and that you mentioned that the aftermath was not very credible, but could you sort of elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, sir. I'd be happy to. This was an extremely complex maneuver. The 757 passed by the Pentagon at relatively high altitude, 30 degrees off of the angle that it would need for the final penetration. It descended over 8,000 feet and made a 330-degree tight radius turn, which would have required a G-force uncomfortably high and maybe typical for a fighter jet or a cruise missile, but very unusual for a 757. Further, for the pilot, who on that particular flight was Hani Hanjour, known to be below average operating a Cessna 172, for him to conceivably pull off that maneuver is, I've operated that airplane myself many times, and I can tell you a maneuver like that is extremely difficult to do. You're making a turn of 330 degrees all the while the target is behind you, and you cannot reference it visually as you're coming down. Leveling off at mere feet above the ground at a speed, what did I say the speed of that airplane was?
We only have this room, I think, until
6 o'clock.
Six. So If you want to find, I mean, you're going to be down by the
We're
by the lake, right?
We're just going to go outside on the street. For if anyone is interested in seeing the thermite demonstration
on the street,
the reason I'd like to do this demonstration is because precisely of the melting temperature of steel. We saw molten iron coming out of the building that had to be at least 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit. Jet fuel and office furniture will not get within 2,000 degrees of that temperature. But thermite, the demonstration I'm going to show you, will get up to 4,500 degrees within 3 seconds of the point of ignition.
Is it possible you can do it at the bottom of the street? I just don't want to, you know,
we don't want to burn down the hotel.
No, we want to be good neighbors, and we don't want to give any impression that there's any risk.
Okay. Even though there isn't.
Okay. No. Yeah, I just don't want to
give that impression.